Thanks for coming along, everyone. We'll start with a video. So what I'm going to do is we'll ship this across here, and we'll watch a bit of a video. Sound, no.
Everyone in place? And let's see. Omnivores, away from the herbivores. Carnivores, settle down. Oh, I do hope everyone ate before they came. Sire, all is ready for the presentation of the young prince. Oh, look.
Oh, look.
No doubt about it there.
So this is what our friends in the movie industry call an animatic. And what they do early in the process, particularly for animations, sometimes for live-action films, is they take rough storyboards or rough sketches and they string them together like this. They take some stock music, so some generic African music in this case. Elton John hadn't come along yet with the Circle of Life. They take one voice actor who does every single character, and they put together these animatics early in the process of creating a new film. And just flip back to the slides. Five reasons why they do this. Help me out. Why do they make these low-res animatics?
Cheap.
Yes? It's not on my list, but it is cheap. No, it's cheap, but I want to know, why is it important to do it cheap?
Because you can change it.
Ah, now we're talking. You can change it, right? So that's number... Where's my mouse? That's number two. This is like tech ed bingo. Four more reasons down the back. Pardon what?
Fail fast.
Yeah, is that... Or, look, I'll give you the first one. Otherwise, we'll be here all day, right? Also down the back. Easy to explain. Awesome. You guys are good at this. I'm going to have to let you all go early. Two more.
Portable.
Pardon?
It's portable.
It is. It's portable and accessible, which is actually a point coming up a little bit later. Defines the scope. Awesome. I call that define a common vision. One more reason, which you've kind of hinted at. Flush out, potential problems before you've invested too much, which comes back to the cheap point, right? So that's why our friends in the movie business make these animatics, and that's the five reasons I want to talk to you today about why we might be doing or introducing or increasing the amount of prototyping that we do in our projects. So that's what you've all got yourself into today. Last chance. Okay. Oh, look, there's a clicker. This is me. My name's Shane Morris. I'm a UX guy. I do a bunch of things. Today I put up a picture of a blog that I do occasionally with a colleague of mine, Matt Morford. It's called 101 Things I Should Have Learned in Interaction Design School. And I put that up today because I'm going to show a couple of examples from that blog today. So that's me. We're in the architecture track. So here's a quote from an architect, old school architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. An architect's most useful tools are an eraser at the drafting board and a wrecking bar at the site. So what he's telling us is that we are going to make mistakes. When you're an architect, you'll make all sorts of mistakes that you don't anticipate until build time. there's two types of mistakes here. On the left, we've got an escalator that goes nowhere, which I presume was a mistake, unless it was some sort of really sort of esoteric sort of comment on the futility of... Anyway. And on the right, we have what you might call a cosmetic fail. Which sort of design failure is easiest to fix? The cosmetic one, right? And this is really important, and this comes back to why we're prototyping. Even though this is a failure, this is possibly fixable, you know, in the late stages just before delivery. If we discover this problem in the dying moments of our project, we've pretty much got to pull the thing apart and put it back together if we've still got a job. So that's what we're talking about today, using prototyping as a way to envision the product or the service that we're creating, as well as a way to flush out potential problems, potential mistakes that we've made. So here's how I say it on that blog. Like buildings, applications break at the joins. It's the journey between pages or screens, not the pages and screens themselves, that cause the most problems for users. Plus, the problems with the journey are the most expensive problems to fix. So traditionally, when we design software, and certainly when we design websites, we tend to think of it as a series of static screens or pages. And in the olden days, we pretty much got away with that. But it's a lot harder when we design these richer experiences, these whizzy interactive apps. Can we get a few more volunteers to move across so that we can free up a few more seats for the guys at the back? It's easy to fix problems on any one page or screen of our application or our site. If we've got the flow wrong, and I've made this point in a few talks at TechEd, that's a lot harder, it's a lot more expensive, and a lot more embarrassing to have to fix. So to avoid these sorts of problems, we have to do a few different things. And the first thing is, we have to find those problems early, when there's time and budget enough to fix them. We have to identify those areas where there is potential risk and focus most of our investigation on those areas. The other thing we need to do to make sure that when we don't assemble the whole product together at the end of the day and find out that there are inconsistencies or problems with the user journey, is we need to make sure that everyone's building the same thing and is working to a current common vision. We need to understand how any one feature relates to the features around it and the other features within the product. Then we need to make sure our stakeholders are reassured that we know what we're doing and that we're building what it is that they wanted us to build. We need to communicate that to our stakeholders and within the team. And we also need to get across what it's going to be like to use our new product or service. And I mean, I guess this is the game we're in now that we're talking about consumer-facing applications and services, when we're talking about user experience. And so I talk about prototyping a lot, just specifically about user experience, but I want to broaden that discussion today and talk about how prototyping can help us address all of these sorts of things. So back to our real-world architects. They say it this way: design with models. And 101 Things I Learned in Architecture School is actually a book that we basically stole the idea of for our 101 Things we Should Have Learned in Interaction Design School. It's a great book if you're interested in design or architecture. It's a classic toilet side book. I guess these days you'd have your tablet devices instead, but it's a great book for the dunny. So like I said, us UX guys, we prototype as a way of life because we're not very bright. We tend to get it wrong. In fact, you know, and I've talked about this before here at TechEd, the underlying assumption of all UX, like all design, is to fail early, fail quickly, to iterate and evolve your solution in order to discover the best solution or the best solution that you can in the time and scope available. And I say unlike our engineering friends, because the thing about user experience design or any sort of design is that you can't take a specification on paper, run it through an algorithm, or just think about it really deeply and design and specify the solution. Unlike our friends who build bridges or architect network architectures or systems architectures, for that matter, where you've got a good chance that your paper solution will work if you've been appropriately rigorous. When it comes to UX, we can't do that. So we do this iterative thing, and I guess the thing we're talking about today is this build phase. So we do some research, we understand what users want to do or how they work, we design potential solutions, and we build them in some form, sketch, scenario, prototype, whatever it is, in order to evaluate, to validate it with our user population, and around we go. That's how user experience works. And so in the good old days, prototyping for us user experience people meant things like paper prototypes. We used to love doing paper prototypes. We still love doing paper prototypes because they're a way for us to explore different options in a really agile manner. It's really easy for us to change our mind. It's a medium that's very easy for us to show to our customers and get and users and get them trying it out. And I've got a couple of slides about paper prototyping coming up. And since the web, we've also done these things called wireframes, which are kind of like black and white allocations of functions and controls and content to pages inside some big sitemap. So this, you know, until recently, or until a few years ago, this is the way UX people like me tended to do their early prototyping. The problem is that they're relatively static. So when these rich internet applications come along, these WYSI applications that grow and shrink and expand and contract and panels appear and disappear and spin and fade and pike and twist, and it's not sufficient to simply just lay out, assign features to pages. Because we're designing an experience, right? And as I said there, it's less about, in modern applications, it's less about the user navigating to the features or content they want, and it's more about the user staying in place, you can imagine, and summoning different types of functionality and content to them, right? It's the whole idea of a one-page website, or the rich internet application. So this requires us to do more design, and it also requires us to be a bit more exploratory in terms of designing the right experience, because I think it's relatively easy to just assign functions to pages in a sitemap, for example. And in the architecture world, we can compare that to an architectural plan to the model or the previews or the visualization that that an architect might do. And the difference here is in the plan, you can see how an architect has allocated features to rooms. This room has the following plumbing and a window here and a door here, and it's shaped like this. And basically what the architect is doing is going through the list of requirements of the building and saying, that goes in that room, that goes in that room, I'm going to need a room for that. And the rooms need to be allocated in relation to each other in the following way. Anyone here an information architect? Good, so I can totally diss information architects. That's what they tend to do, right? They build a site map of your website and they allocate features to functions. And there are actually several quotes from real-world architects that say, if you are merely doing that, if you are merely allocating functions to rooms in a building, you're not doing architecture, because you also have to design an experience. So the point here, these are two Frank Gehry buildings. The one on the left is the Disney Theatre in LA. So you can see in plan view, we can see how rooms are allocated and how they relate to each other. This is a model for the UTS building that they're building in Sydney, also a Gehry building. I can't help thinking that the architects next door were working on a normal building and they kind of didn't like it, so they threw it out in the trash, kind of got a bit squashed. Gehry came in one day and said, I'll take that. Those suckers in Sydney can totally have the squashed building. But the point is, right, the difference between allocating features to pages and screens versus designing and understanding the experience that you're going to try and create. These dynamic UIs are challenging for us to envision for the reasons I said. We need to do a lot more exploration to understand if we've got the experience we wanted rather than have we just allocated the right number of features to the right number of screens. I keep repeating myself. So we need to be able to explore different options really quickly, and we need to think more about the experience that we're creating, not just the functional spec. And the problem is, how do we document these richer interactions? How do we get them down on paper? How do I get them down on paper so that you guys can build them? How do we as a team understand what it is we need to create from an experience point of view? Because hopefully I've got the point across right now that we can't add user experience at the end. We can't get the functional spec complete and make sure that we've our performance is right and our reliability is right and we've delivered all the features and there's no bugs and there's no memory leaks and whatever the hell else developers do, I don't know. Are there any developers in the room? totally just lost my audience. It's easy to do. I don't know. You serialize your linked lists and you put your Star Wars figurines into first normal form, and I don't know. I mean, keep digging. So the point is, it's really easy for us to document the individual states, the static states of an application. It's harder to document those transitions, that journey. And so prototyping has had to evolve, therefore, to help us do some of that. So I quickly sort of brainstormed different types of prototypes. And I guess the important point here is that, from my point of view, a prototype is any mechanism that allows us to better visualize the product that we're creating in a way that doesn't require someone to look at a spec and sort of try to imagine the product. We're trying to visualize the actual experience, the actual product that we're creating. So you know, how to document those transitions? We could take our existing paper prototype or wireframe and have annotations and arrows and lines all over it and try to annotate that way. We can write an awful lot of text, so, you know, a long, you know, text description of how this panel is supposed to slide in. But I just do not know how to describe in text exactly how long this needs to take and at which point it starts to slow down and whether there's a slight jiggle at the end. All the sorts of things that people like me obsess about and you guys just roll your eyes. Any UX designers before I insult all of you? Okay. We, in order to stop bothering our developer buddies, we need to be able to try out these ideas and then specify these ideas in a succinct way. And there's a trade-off here. The lower fidelity sort of techniques at the top, I can potentially, you know, I can be more agile, I can try out different ideas more quickly, but I can't be as specific. As I get down to animatics and interactive prototypes, I can more specifically specify how the behavior of an application, but at the cost of the effort involved in doing that. And that's the trade-off we make when we're prototyping. And the way we deal with that prototype is we start up there and we end down here. So over the course of the project, we gradually increase the fidelity of our prototype up to the point where the actual working code starts to take over as the prototype or as the specification, at least in the main. So prototyping's back in town, and I'm not here to talk about Sketchflow. In other presentations, I've done the Sketchflow bit. I just want to talk about prototyping generally. I'm old enough to remember, anyone else remember RAD, Rapid Application Development? Yeah, cool. Well, not cool. It was pretty sucky really. We had these prototyping tools that were supposed to allow us to do all the things that I just described. But the problem was that they were thinly veiled programmers' tools, which really required an expert user to operate. And so I certainly went through this pain back in the 90s of using these tools to generate prototypes. And I'd have to work with a prototyper. So everything that I was doing had to be interpreted through the eyes of the prototyper, who naturally heard things differently to the way I thought I said them. And I don't blame them for that. Firstly, they're trying to work quickly because it's supposed to be rapid. So when they hear one thing and they think, well, I've got this pre-built thing or there's an off-the-shelf thing that's kind of like that, I'll drop that in. And us having to wait a week for the prototype to come back before we did our next iteration just became more and more unworkable. Some of these problems have been resolved with modern prototyping tools like Sketchflow, like Balsamiq, like Axure, iRise. There's some sort of high-end prototyping tools right now. Some of them suffer from the problem that you've got to learn how to use them. Others are a little bit less sophisticated, but easier to learn. So that was prototyping in the old days. Prototyping, we hope, is back in town. And as I said, there's different types of prototypes, from low fidelity through to high fidelity, through to static, from static through to interactive and dynamic. And I'm going to show you examples of some of these things. So at the top left, every year I come to TechEd and I talk about activity scenarios. They're stories, no pictures, just stories. We'll see an example of that. And you can see that, so, you know, over the course of the project, we might start up there as usual, you know, and you know, by halfway through the project, maybe we've got graphically treated interactive prototype. Maybe we haven't. Some projects are going to stop sort of more over here. Your mileage may vary. So I just want to recap why we think prototyping is a good idea. validate the concept in concrete terms. So rather than describe, and you've all had this problem, rather than describing the spec in abstract terms, in use cases and data flow diagrams and ERDs and whatever the heck else, we want to visualize the concept and then validate it with users and stakeholders in concrete terms, in other words, in the context of real use. We want to try out our ideas at low risk. So we don't want to invest a whole lot of time, money, emotions and code into an idea that we might find out in execution doesn't meet the mark for all sorts of different reasons. We want to find the issues that we don't know about before it's too late to fix them, and we need to sell the vision. This is the thing that we're making to our stakeholders, to our customers, to all the people outside the team, and then within the team, and I think this is a really important point, and we've had some real success with this. The other role of the prototype is to bring the broader team together with a common vision. And by broader team, I mean the coders and the architects and the data modelers and the UX designers, but I also mean the tech writers, the trainers, the product managers, the marketers, the whole ecosystem around the product or service that we're making, allowing them to have a common vision and to understand this is the thing that we're making. And possibly more importantly, there's a slide coming up about it, making it easier for someone to understand that if we change something, if we change this feature or if we add this new feature, better understand how that impacts the overall proposition. And that's one of the biggest problems with these abstract specs that we used in the olden days, is that there was no cost of adding new features. There was no cost of adding new business rules. In fact, our business analyst friends, any business analysts in the room, I'm not going to insult you. You're probably the only ones who are going to get away scot-free, because you poor bastards have got a real problem with your job, right? It's not your fault. But you're rewarded for detail. And when you're doing old school business analysis, when you're just injecting more business rules into the spec, you've got no way to know when you've crossed that invisible line of it's enough, or it's too much, or it's really hard for you to visualize how this new feature is going to interact with or interfere with other features in the overall user experience. Having a prototype is a great way to manage scope creep, let's just say it out loud, and also to help us understand the relationship between features and functions. Next. I was going to talk about each of these in turn in a little bit more detail and show some examples. First one, validate the concept. And I talked a little bit about paper prototyping already. I'm a big fan of paper prototyping because it's a technology that everyone understands. So I can, in the very early phases of a project, I can take a paper prototype to my users, try out ideas with them, or even get them to generate ideas with me, because it's a non-threatening technology. And it's very easy for me to do a usability test with a paper prototype made out of sticky notes and butcher's paper. And when the user finds a potential problem with the workflow or whatever it is, we can switch into design mode really easy, because I can thrust the texter into the user's hand and say, well, how did you expect this screen to look? And I'm not saying user is now designer, but user can express their requirement or their expectation on paper with their sticky notes and butcher's paper, and I might take that way and interpret it slightly differently. But nevertheless, I've captured feedback in context. Rather than taking our users, or worse still, our subject matter experts, putting them in a room on their own and getting them to list all the features they could possibly think of, we're now assessing and designing the product in context, because we're asking the user to role play a real task. Imagine you are trying to X. Here's the first page of, literally, of our application. What would you do now? So that's about paper prototypes. Eventually, they become unwieldy because you're dealing with lots of real content, or, as I said, subtle interactions, animations and transitions and stuff like that start to become really difficult to do on paper prototypes. I've certainly done it, and I've had little pieces of cellophane that move around for highlights and stuff like that. But there is a point where the novelty of your paper prototype kind of detracts from the real purpose of the task, and you need to move on to maybe a wireframe or a clickable wireframe or any number of other prototyping techniques. So here's an example. Here's an example of us using a prototype at Cochlear. Some of you were at the keynote, last night, and Jane, she's the product manager for this product, actually, was talking about the work we've been doing at Cochlear. So there's a a zoomed-in screenshot from a prototype. This is a Sketchflow prototype that we built at Cochlear for testing out this user interface that audiologists are going to be using for tuning and programming people's implants, their bionic hearing implants. So what's going on is we've got, this is inside an audiologist's lab because we try to create the real experience. So it's all soundproof and really quite odd. If you go into one of these rooms and you realize how much noise there is in the real world when you go into a room that has no noise. If some of you are musicians and have been in a recording studio, you've had the same experience. So we've got an audiologist. This is not a real audiologist because for privacy reasons we don't record the images of our test subjects. Our prototype running on a laptop, and in this case we've got, this is Jason, you can just make out he's got a processor, speech processor on his ear there. He's not actually implanted, he's one of the coders on the team. What we do is, in this situation, we get the coders in to play the role of the recipients, because we're not testing the recipients, we're testing the audiologist. Sorry, we're never testing the user, we're testing the user's ability to use our application. It's a test of us, not a test of them. It's important. The great thing about having the coders in to do the testing is firstly that it's a great way for other members of the team to picture and understand the real context of use, but also because in the early days, well, our prototype was never functional. It never actually programmed anyone's implants, but it did generate different noises and stuff like that to sort of simulate some of the stuff that goes on. The advantage of having the coder there as the recipient is that he can respond appropriately, knowing what the prototype should do at any one point if it was a real application. So there'll be situations in this role play where Jason will say that he can't hear the audiologist because the audiologist has turned off the person's hearing. It happens all the time. And if we hadn't have done these role plays, any number of mistakes that I'd made in the user interface design wouldn't have been found until too late, because there's a complex interplay between machine and a thing called a programming pod, and there's a wire running into the processor, the processor has to be on the head, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong, and the sequence of things. In any case, it was these role plays that thrashed out all those problems. The other fun thing about getting the coders in here is that we needed them to play specific roles, which isn't necessarily a good idea generally, but there are specific scenarios that we need to go through for kids, for example, specific exercises. And so, not Jason, but another guy on the team, Xerxes, is a big East Asian dude. I think some of you know him. He's sort of well-known in the community. He had to play a 9-year-old girl. And we do an exercise called a sweep, where we basically stimulate all of the electrodes in turn, and the pitch increases, it's kind of like a piano, and the idea of a sweep is to make sure that there aren't any bumps in that sort of pitch progression. And one of the funniest testing moments of my life was when we ran the imaginary sweep with Xerxes, and he sort of swung his legs and said, "It sounds like a rainbow." Anyway, that's probably not important right now. So validating the concept in a real context, recreating the real context of use as best we possibly can. And the next point is trying out ideas at low risk before we've invested too much in them. So, and that starts with sketching. These are some of the actual sketches that we did when we were starting to work out how the Qantas Windows Phone app that some of you might have seen was demonstrated at MIX, how that thing was going to come together. And it allows us to have low emotional investment, and it also allows us to pick the level of fidelity that's appropriate for the point or the sophistication of our thinking. Here's another sketch where I started to actually annotate the steps that a user would need to go through to complete a specific task. And here's a different type of sketching. This is not sketching with pencils. This is sketching with a whiteboard and magnets. So on the left is Sally Bielany from Object Consulting, and this is a video of her basically prototyping the interactions for this surface application that they built for the Australian Open Tennis a couple of years ago. And Sally's basically brainstorming what will happen when you place different cards on the surface, because the red things represent content that's supposed to spray out of the card when you place the card on the surface. Because there were duplicates of cards, we had to understand what happens if you put two of the same sort of card down, for example. And Sally's just brainstorming that as we speak, trying out different ideas with the team. So that's a form of sketching, yeah? A very, very, very low fidelity prototype. You get the idea. So this is about trying out our ideas before we've invested too much in them. The next point is to identify issues that we didn't know that we had, and that comes back to the usability testing that we were just talking about. Here's another example. In this case, we're using an interactive prototype of a remote control. So this is also a Cochlear project. So we're working on the remote controls that recipients will use to program their hearing or adjust their hearing during the day. It's kind of like, it's actually literally about that size. It costs one metric shitload of money to tool these devices, right? You have to get a die made for injection molding, and they cost a bomb. So we don't want to get it wrong, particularly around the button configuration, how many buttons they are, what they're called, how they're configured in relation to each other. So we did a bunch of testing with a touchscreen prototype. So this is a Sketchflow prototype, deliberately vagued out, a Sketchflow prototype running on a Windows 7 slate, touch slate. So it's not a perfect reproduction of the experience of holding the thing in your hand, but it allowed us, we got real recipients and their parents to come in and use this prototype, touching and dragging and whatever, when we recorded over their shoulder what they were doing. Brings us to the fourth one, selling the vision. So I've been mainly focusing on UX-y things, but the other really important role of a prototype is to communicate to the stakeholders and investors what it is we're making, or more to the point, you know, are they getting what they're paying for. So old school specifications, and I kind of made this point before I got to this slide, don't really cut it when it comes to this sort of communication, particularly when, as I said, we're trying to design these, you know, it's not just about how many, have we got the right number of features, but also what sort of experience are we trying to create. So different techniques that we can use to sort of sell that vision. And one is the storyboard. So this is the first page of literally the storyboard that we use to pitch the Qantas app to Qantas. So this is a PowerPoint deck, basically. On the right-hand column, we had a story, a scenario, that described the experience of Joe that was going to have using this future application that didn't exist yet, that we called the Smart Boarding Pass. On the front page there, I've got a picture of the Qantas website homepage, but as you go into the deck, sometimes I've got quick sketches of how an individual screen or page might look. Oftentimes, I've got no sketch or picture of the UI yet. So I was throwing in sort of what you'd call atmospheric pictures. There was a coffee cup, and there was someone waiting at a boarding gate, and you know, stuff like that to sort of envision the experience, even though I didn't have a UI to show yet. And to be honest, the actual UI was not nearly so important as this is the experience that we want to create. And it was literally this deck that we used to convince Qantas to build this thing that we're working on now. And then yesterday, and I wasn't expecting this, if you guys were in the developer plenary yesterday, you saw this new feature in Visual Studio VNext, which is a storyboarding add-on for Visual Studio running in PowerPoint. So this is the same video. I don't know anything more about it than you guys did. I watched the same video as you last night and then rushed out and tried to get the video. I'm just going to play a little bit of it, but it is the same video that most of you saw yesterday.
And I have an idea of how I might implement that. Let's use the Storyboard Assistant. Now, we've built this into a tool that you're probably already using today, and that's Microsoft PowerPoint. You'll notice here that I've modeled my existing web application. I've used a number of rich controls here, so you can see, for example, that I have a data grid, and I can come in here and edit all of these fields as I want. Over here on the right, you see a shape library, so we give you a lot of the controls that you're probably already using in your applications today. You'll notice here that we give you different templates. So here's a phone template, so I can model how that works. And you can also model things like user interaction as well. So as I create a new customer and click Create, you can show how that flows to the next page. So it's a really nice tool. I quickly modeled this in about 15 minutes. It's very easy to work with. So let's scroll down to the customer-facing portal. This is where customers see a list of all of their open tickets. And one way that we might implement that requirement that's coming from the business is to just take a map and show exactly where the technician is at any point in time. So here I can show back to the customer and they can see that their technician is just down the street. And now I can show this to the president and have a conversation about whether or not this is what they wanted. And as it turns out, in this case, the president pointed out that we don't really want our customers to know exactly where all of our technicians are at any point in time. Instead, he would rather see something like this.
So I'll turn the sound down and let it run out. What I love about this is the accessibility of PowerPoint. As I said, I've done a lot of work in Sketchflow, but it's a sophisticated tool. So not everyone can be productive in it without a fair bit of learning. PowerPoint, what I love about it is, firstly, most people already know how to use it. Secondly, it's a medium that's very easy to distribute to stakeholders and other people. It's a medium that they can not only play on their own PCs, but they can also annotate, provide comments, even potentially edit. I think it's a great idea. And in fact, I've done a lot of my prototyping and wireframing in the past in PowerPoint. I guess this thing's going to take it to the next level. So that's pretty cool. Meanwhile, back at the slide deck. If you download the deck, you can get the URL for that video. Speaking about selling vision, here's another real example from my life. And we were working on this Lonely Planet surface proof of concept a few years ago. And we had to sell it to a few different stakeholders, not just Lonely Planet, who were pretty much on board with it, but the people who actually build and operate the Lonely Planet store. The Lonely Planet store isn't actually operated by Lonely Planet. It's licensed to some people who know how to make stores, right? And we had to sell the idea to them. And they were having trouble understanding the vision until the guys at Amnesia Razorfish made this little prototype. It is super low fidelity, but it needed to get... This is the point I was making about getting across the experience, the transitions and the dynamics and the physics of a modern application. So this cruddy little prototype on a surface table... And I was literally there when we presented this to the stakeholder from the store operators, Lagardère, and it was clearly a light bulb moment for him. He suddenly understood what it was we thought we were going to make, even though an awful lot of imagination was required to translate this into the final experience that we ended up making. I just filmed this on my phone, so it's not awesome. That was it. A little 30-second demo. Was key to us getting approval to go ahead with this project. So you can see I'm showing you all sorts of different ways to prototype lo-fi, hi-fi, static, interactive, and you guys are going to be picking the method that's best for you at different times. This last point I've said already I really want to emphasize the advantages of using a prototype as an early communication tool, particularly early in the project, so that everyone knows what it is we're building, particularly the people who can't or don't choose to read the detailed specifications. And wireframes are a common way of doing that. Despite my talking about the various deficiencies of a wireframe, it is a very agile and productive way for someone like me to say, Here's the experience. I probably won't wireframe every screen. I might just storyboard a series of wireframes to show a journey. It's a great way to start to see how the different features actually string out into an experience. But it's also a great way to reveal potential features or functions that that we might have missed, or that we might have misread in terms of how they needed to work or what they needed to do. They show the flow of the application. They show how we've allocated content to pages and screens. So this is a wireframe from a project, a Microsoft project I worked on up in Queensland a few years ago now. And this is the actual real page. And at this stage of the project, the difference between wireframe and rendered final page was very little. It was just a case of applying the visual styles that we'd set in place in a style guide. The problem with wireframes is, per se, They're not interactive. So you can't, you can't experience or test or specify the way things scroll and move and grow and shrink in a modern application. But probably most of you are working with wireframes today, yeah? Who's wireframing today? Not as many as I expected. Okay, cool. From this same project, here's what we call the design wall. This is Matt Morford, who I mentioned earlier. And what we did is we appropriated a wall in the project, and we basically just use it as a filing cabinet. We called it a horizontal filing cabinet. We basically just put up, starting with our personas, our user personas, and then our scenarios, and then our wireframes, and our screen flows, through to final mock-ups and all sorts of other paraphernalia on the wall. And that was kind of our living spec for the UX. But something really interesting happened. We kind of hoped it would, but it happened better than we ever expected. It became a rallying point for the whole project. So we'd be sitting, these were our seats along the left here. And this is this is a weekly event called Walking the Wall. So every, I think it was Thursday, it's a while ago now, every Thursday morning we'd basically walk whoever wanted to come to the wall walk, we'd walk them through what had been added to the wall in the last week. It was like a 20-minute meeting, it wasn't prepared, we just sort of stood back and said, oh, okay, we've added this, or we've changed that, or there's a bunch of sticky notes that have appeared. We left a pad of sticky notes beside down the road there, and we encourage people to just, any sort of comment, whether it's feedback, criticism, suggestion, whatever, just paste it up there, we'll deal with it. We wanted a really low barrier of entry for people to provide feedback about the UX and about the product as a whole. What was really awesome is that we'd be sitting there doing our work, and these impromptu meetings would start up at the wall about things that we really, had nothing to do with. You know, the data modelers would show up, or the architects, or whomever, and start to have a conversation about the stuff they needed to have a conversation about, but pointing at the UX on the wall. And this really brought home to me this point about having a common communication, a common point of focus. Because it allowed those guys to say, no, when I say we need to cache the data, look at this screen. Or see this, these two things come from two different sources. Or there's no way we can, we can pre-cache all, whatever it was, right? Those conversations would happen, and we would be attempt to be oblivious to them, but they would happen around this thing because this was the closest thing to a vision that anyone had of the thing that we are making. And I'm harping on about this point because I think it's really worthwhile us. And the main point that I want you guys to take away and think about is, while prototyping is awesome for UX and it's also awesome for stakeholder management, it's also an awesome team communication tool. And I forgot to, I've just realized that I forgot to mention, no, I did mention, it's great for scope creep control as well, because if you've got a well-visualized idea of the on-screen experience, then when new features appear or get suggested, what automatically happens is that people immediately start to think about how does that feature surface itself on the UI? Where does it go in the UI? What other features does it belong with? How does it potentially affect those features? How does it affect our typical user journeys that we're trying to support? So coming back to the point about BAs and requirements, it allows us to be more questioning, I guess, of new features and requirements. Allows us to see them in context as we're discovering them and adding them. Otherwise, like I said, it's all too easy to just keep adding features, right? And we've all been there. Until you see how those things come together in a product, only then can you start to weigh up your features in a realistic way. So we saw a few different, not every example of prototypes. We saw activity scenarios, so they're day in the life of, we haven't seen one yet, but I'll show you one in a minute. They're just stories. Sketches, we saw a PowerPoint storyboard from Qantas. We saw wireframes. I didn't quite point out the comp, but the comp is where we take a selection of typical screens. It's a term from graphic design, short for composition. We take a series of typical screens, maybe five, and we give them the full graphic treatment. And this is another way we do stakeholder management. So it's not really a form of prototyping, I guess, in that sense, but stakeholders can get nervous when they see a lot of wireframes and black and white sketchy style prototypes. They want to see, you know, they want to see the glossy finish that they're paying for, right? They, you know, a lot of stakeholders think that, you know, 60 to 70% of their budget is spent on the drop shadows and you know, and I let them believe that, you know, we're bringing in the most expensive cyan pixels from Russia. They're quality pixels. We're really lucky. Paper prototypes we talked about. Clickable wireframes, I didn't really mention, but you can imagine how easy it is to drop your wireframes into PowerPoint and hook them up, or in Visio you can actually do some basic interactive stuff. Well, there's some more advanced wireframing tools like Axure that are built to create clickable wireframes. We might make something that's more interactive but untreated. In other words, it doesn't have the visuals yet. And that's the sort of thing that you would typically make in something like Sketchflow. Animatics would be, much like the Lion King animatic that we saw at the start, is a sequence of screens put together into a video that someone can watch and see how a transaction goes. You don't see a lot of these because you've got to be able to build them, and it's kind of a little bit involved. The best examples I ever saw of these were at MYOB in Melbourne a few years ago, and the guys there were designing some new features for one of their products, and one of the guys there who had some video editing skills created these animatics in After Effects, and they were little 30-second videos that showed exactly how things were going to transition and the steps that took up a prototype. Great way to, you know, particularly if you're selling a quite radical idea, a great way to put them together, but a little bit labour-intensive. And you can go all the way through to a treated interactive if necessary. As I said, it's worth mentioning, you won't always do this, because by the time you get about here, you've probably got enough code in place that maybe you're not going to venture into a non-functional treated prototype. So who's, by this stage, maybe it's worth a bit of a show of hands. Who's doing any of these sorts of prototypes today? Awesome. Oh, well, you can all leave. I'll fill out your evaluations for you. It's fine. I mean, many of these techniques are not techniques that are foreign to you. I think what's different and what's sort of been, you know, has become a dawning realization for me is how powerful they are for things other than just specifying the UI. And that's one of the key points. So I was going to quickly, we've got a sort of 5 or 10 minutes left, and I wanted to quickly show you a little bit more about how we're prototyping at Cochlear, and then we'll wrap up. So a quick little case study at Cochlear. So I don't have to go through this stuff because Jane talked to you yesterday about the cochlear implant that goes inside your head, the processor that goes outside your head with the little magnet. My favourite part in testing is when the kids are bored, they get the thing and they go, thunk, thunk, thunk. Someone said to me last night, I was talking about it last night, and someone said it must be the deaf person's equivalent of spinning your pen. You know, thunk. But they're turning their hearing off and on when they do that. It's cool. And then there's this complicated software. This is not the software we've been working on. This is the most sophisticated piece of software called Custom Sound. That's used to program these guys. And so we were building some software that does some of the features of Custom Sound, plus some new features, kind of targeted a new market. I won't go into too much of that detail. What I want to tell you about is how we prototype. So I talked about the testing before. We started with this vision. We basically were sold on the Sketchflow idea of we could make a living spec. So we started off with the intention that we were going to make a fully treated, visually precise, interactive prototype of the entire product in Sketchflow as it was at least the starting proposition, and we didn't end up completely using Sketchflow. I'll talk about that. That was our vision. The reality hit probably about for 3 or 4 months into the project that because the interactions were quite complex, I'll be honest, the Sketchflow prototype itself was starting to get quite unwieldy. And part of that is because Yaz and me are not developers, so we weren't while we weren't coding as such, we were building a thing out of modules and components and reusable user controls and stuff like that in Expression Blend. And our architecture, such as it was, started to strain under the weight of the quite sophisticated prototype. So one of the first decisions we made is to split the visual treatment from the prototype so that we didn't have to keep the Sketchflow prototype visually accurate. So the design, the styling of the design we took out and we specified in static Photoshop files and with some annotations and specifications. And the prototype we kept it, it's gone beyond sketchy style, but it's in a black and white style. So that we could be more agile without having to worry about the exact visual treatments. That was the first thing we did. We then went the third step, and some of the elements we basically chose various elements to not prototype at all. So these were some of the more obscure flows. And so instead what we did was kind of like, what would you call these sort of... flow diagrams, screen flow diagrams. So for typical scenarios, particularly the ones that were sort of like a sequence of events in a wizard style, we created these are in PowerPoint. So you can see how we quickly sort of had to be a little bit more realistic about how much we could prototype. And I wanted to share this with you guys because I don't, particularly if you're doing these advanced sort of very sophisticated prototypes, this is one of the trade-offs you're going to have to make. And you have to be on the lookout for the point at which the prototype becomes unwieldy. I think there are things we could have done better. We could have been a little bit more proactive in terms of how we architected the prototype. We could have even maybe lent on the developers in the team to maybe give us a bit more advice, because at the end of the day in Blend, you're building a Visual Studio project. So there are user controls and screens and stuff and... we could have done a better job of that. And it's worth saying that, because it's relevant, even though we're here at a Microsoft conference, the majority of the prototype in the end ended up not being in Sketchflow, but instead in Flash. And the reason for that is Yaz, who we saw before, was a very skilled Flash designer, but was trying to learn Sketchflow on the job. And the reality was, and once again, we might have done it differently in hindsight, is that he got to the point where he could be more productive in Flash. So key message to take away is you've got to pick the right tool for your team. So we're getting towards the end. I just want to sort of explicitly say point out some of the attributes of what I think is a good prototype. We've got five of them. It needs to allow us to put ourselves in the user's shoes, to imagine the experience that a user will have. It needs to have an appropriate level of detail and effort to how invested we are in the idea. Does that make sense? So early in the project, we don't want to invest too much time and effort when we don't quite know the experience we're creating, but that the level of investment in the prototype needs to match the level of clarity of the product or the service that we're creating. They need to be agile, which, as I said, started to become a problem at Cochlear. They need to be accessible, particularly for this point about stakeholders. They need to be easy to get at and easy to provide feedback to, and they need to, kind of related to the appropriate level of investment, they need to have the appropriate level of detail. And I've got a few examples to illustrate those five points. So put the reader in the user's shoes. I told you there was a storyboard scenario coming. I'm a huge fan of activity scenarios, and I don't think they're used nearly enough. Basically, this is the first design. For me as a UX guy, the first key deliverable from my work on a project is half a dozen-ish of these stories that describe the day in the life of the end user and the experience that they're going to have using the product. And sometimes for something like the Lonely Planet project, there's a lot of emotion and it's very, you know, it's high, heavy on experience. You know, we need to create the sense of the excitement and discovery and the social aspects, whatever it is, of the experience that we're creating. If we're doing something that's a bit more workaday, line of business apps or sort of more transactional apps, we still write scenarios. We might go a little lighter on the emotional stuff, although it's still important because we still need to capture people's motivations. But we might, instead, what we're focusing on is the workflow. Have we got things laid out in the right sequence? Do we understand the sequence of events and features that is going to support people to work in the way they need to work? The beauty of scenarios is that everyone loves a story. they're accessible in a way that stakeholders and everyone can read them and give us feedback, and there's no UI at all in these. We never say, and then Matt presses the print button or anything like that. There's what we describe is the conversation between a person or people and the system. And that's your first design. That's your first user experience. It just doesn't happen to have any screens. So one of the best examples of putting you in the user's shoes. Having an appropriate level of investment. So this is another extract from the 101 Things I Learned in Interaction Design School blog. And it's about the appropriate use of fluffy clouds. We are all tempted to be as precise as we can in order to impress the people we work with. You've got to really, really careful to ask yourself how much deeper detail is appropriate for this stage of the project. And it's perfectly okay to say fluffy cloud and the transaction history goes here. And the reason I want to do that in my early prototypes is so that when someone's reviewing it, they don't focus on the transaction history part, which is the bit that I possibly haven't designed or haven't designed well enough. At the early stage of the project, I'm worried about the journey, right? Have I assembled the right features and functions into the right pages in the right sequence? So it's perfectly okay, in fact it's a good idea, to obscure some of the detail that might distract people from the stuff that we really care about right now. So, you know, customer details go here, because I don't care what fields we're going to capture in terms of customer details. I'm inevitably going to have that fight with the project team later in the project, because I always do, because they want 27 customer address fields and I want one. And we usually compromise. Anyway, that's beside the point. Prototypes that are easily changeable and can evolve. So here's three snapshots from the Lonely Planet project. The first Sketchflow prototype in sketchy style, a more sort of an untreated but interactive version of the one aspect of the product, and then the final treated version. So a good prototype can evolve and increase in fidelity over the course of your project, up to the point where you don't want to be obsessive about the prototype at the expense of the actual product, right? There's some point where you start to focus on the real thing more than the actual prototype, but the prototype is kind of the filler that gets you to that point. And they need to be accessible. And this is at Cochlear, and this is some ideas we have for some user support materials, once again deliberately taken from a long way off so you can't see the details. But this is a lady from the training materials team. And this is a visitor from India who was visiting the office. And once again, they're not doing our work. They're not talking UX, but the stuff that we stuck on the wall here becomes a focus point for the project and a way for the project to communicate with each other. Another point on accessible, I'll just move quickly through this. This is coming back to that Queensland project. We deliberately chose a point that was in a high traffic area so that we got plenty of sort of passing comments. So even the placement of your prototype can affect maybe its cut through. And having the right level of detail, which I've made this point already. Early in the project, you don't need so much detail. Late in the project, you need to have enough detail to be authentic and believable. And you'll pick the right level of detail as you go. So those were our five attributes of a good prototype, and we're almost at the end. Just to recap, what I call a prototype could be all sorts of things that you already do today. It could be sketches. It could be a clickable PowerPoint presentation. It could be a story. It could be fully treated or interactive. It could even be production code or code that's intended to be production code, but maybe isn't hooked up to real data sources yet. It could be hooked up to dummy data sources, for example. So in many respects, you know, what I'm talking about in terms of prototyping is stuff you guys do today. The real point is how to think about how you can use these prototypes for more than just specifying the user experience. We can use them to validate our ideas in concrete terms. So rather than an abstract specification, here is our idea. What do you think, user? Or what do you think, stakeholder? Or what do you think, customer? We can try out different ideas at relatively low risk because we haven't had to write a whole bunch of code before we try it out with users. the issues, the inevitable issues that we're going to have, but we don't know what they are yet. We can flush them out earlier in the project, before we've written a whole bunch of code, before we've built that elevator escalator that goes nowhere. We can use our prototypes to gather support and communicate to the broader organization. At Cochlear, we used to use our Sketchflow prototypes. We'd post them on the company intranet so that stakeholders from all over the world could always access the latest stage of the prototype. And really, really importantly, is bring the team together with a common vision. So I wanted to, in the last two slides, I wanted to give you two other people's opinions or views on what it is we're doing. So this guy, Tim Brown, is from IDEO, is a famous designer. He talks about design thinking, which is a bit of a buzzword in the design community at the moment, but it's all about prototyping. So when he's designing new products, he says that they've got three phases: an inspiration phase, which is kind of like a research phase; an ideation phase, where you take that research and you generate ideas; and then an implementation phase, where you build it, right? And he says prototypes in different forms have a role in each of those phases. So at the start, you might build prototypes in order to flush out ideas. So you might build deliberately vague prototypes or deliberately provocative prototypes, either or, in order to try initial ideas out on users and customers and use that as he says, an inspiration task, not a validation task. So early on, we're not showing our prototypes to people so that they can say, yep, that's what I want. We're showing our prototypes to people deliberately to help us come up with the right product idea. At the ideation stage, he says, in order to think about your ideas, you have to be able to build them, you have to visualize them. And so they do a lot of prototyping of all sorts of products. And then finally, that visualization, that prototype, is used for two purposes: to sell the idea to customers and stakeholders, and also to control the idea moving forward so that it remains coherent and so that we're all building the same thing together. So just another take on the same stuff that we've been talking about today. We started with a quote from an architect, so I'm going to finish with a quote from an architect. This guy, Alan Cooper, trained as an architect, like a building architect. Some of you might know him. He then became a software developer, and he's known as the father of Visual Basic. And then he became a UX guy. So he's been doing all three of the sorts of roles that we've talked about today, including designing buildings. The only thing more expensive than writing software is writing bad software. And that's really the key point of what we're talking about here with prototyping, as a way to avoid us writing software that we then have to throw away or pull apart. Prototyping, failing early, failing often, being agile is one of the key messages I wanted to get across to you guys today. We made it to the end. Thanks everyone for your attention. I'll take some questions. I think that a prototype is going to become more and more an important tool for a business analyst. I mean, in many ways, when I'm prototyping as a user experience guy, in theory, I'm prototyping the user experience. But you can bet that I'm also flushing out requirements, or I'm visualizing those requirements. So oftentimes, on a project that's working well, I'm working hand in hand with a BA. The stuff that I'm prototyping is informing the requirements. And vice versa, right? Obviously, I'm taking the requirements and trying to visualize them into a UI, but vice versa, as the UI starts to form, BA, business analysts, can start to tweak the requirements in tandem. On that Queensland project, where there was only, for a lot of the time, there was only one UX person on a very big project, what we did is we set in place some templates in PowerPoint. So these weren't so much prototypes as wireframes, it was more of a traditional web application. And the BAs over time, as well as producing traditional, business rules, also started to wireframe the screens to visualize that, and it worked quite well. Depending on your team and where you are and how innovative you're trying to be, you'll find the right mix. I don't think that prototyping replaces requirements or the job of a BA at all, but it's a very powerful tool in the hands of a business analyst, I think. So the question was, should every dev team have a UX person? Yes. However, there aren't very many of them. So you should all hire me. I think, yeah, look, I'm obviously going to be biased. Yes, every project should have a UX person, but, I mean, you're going to have to choose what's the appropriate level of investment. If you're designing, you know, that innovative, groundbreaking experience that's kind of risky in terms of a new proposition to customers or something like that, then obviously UX is more important to you. On another project that maybe is, you know, is less innovative from a UI point of view, a traditional sort of internal line of business, databasey type app, you're going, you know, the UX, while I, of course, will still think it's important, is because it's less speculative, requires less effort. Not every project can have a UX person. I wish they could. The next best thing to do is to identify someone on the project, whether it's a BA or a developer or an architect or whomever, to be the keeper of the user experience. So they might not be formally trained or formally experienced in user experience design, but I think the next best thing you can do is have a center, I won't say a center of excellence, but a center of knowledge around the user experience. Not just QA, but also be the clearinghouse for UX decisions. So that rather than a bunch of UX decisions being made by individual developers, you know, in their individual cubes, they know that when you're doing something that's more than just allocating forms to fields to a page, if it's something more sophisticated than that, then let's at least have a coherent conversation by bringing in this one person who's the keeper of the user experience. Does that make sense? That's a really good question. And so that was one of the problems that we ran into with the Cochlear project. We simply got to the point where 1.5 UX people couldn't create a prototype that was functionally complete. And so we had to start to be more judicious about what we were going to prototype and what we were going to specify in more traditional means. And the answer was the things that were either most mission critical or most risky in terms of, you know, innovative or unusual, you know. So, you know, the settings page that has a bunch of checkboxes and pull drop downs doesn't need to be prototyped. We'll just wireframe that up in PowerPoint, if at all. Some of the tuning exercises where you're adjusting dials and you're generating sounds and it's all quite interactive, that was the stuff that was most important to prototype. And in my experience, that's exactly what you'll do. You'll tend to take stripes or slices through the application because it's really important to prototype end-to-end experience. That's whole that point about the buildings, you know, and the joins. Your first pass will be a series of stripes, and you'll flesh those out in more and more detail, but every project will make its own decision about how much to invest in the prototype based on the resources you've got and how agile you can be with the tools. Thanks. That's a great question. I think if I had to guess, what's going on there is it's about role definition, and the person who's responsible for the UX is typically not good at thinking through all the possible corner cases. I think this is just the reality of how jobs are defined. And it comes back to that's something that BAs are typically really good at, or their job at least requires them to be really good at. So these are all these specific business rules. Those two things have to be brought together, and you know, and maybe that it's your role. Each team is different, but maybe in your team, you know, someone needs to be coming in from that rigorous point of view and sort of saying, well, let's make sure that we've got a place for every business rule. But I would encourage you also to use the prototype or whatever form of specification as a way to be critical about the business rules, to sort of say, well, hang on a sec. Here's this obscure corner case. We have this in the medical field. We do this a lot. We could support that obscure corner case, but at the expense of the overall experience. And this is the point I was making. It's really easy to write that business rule. If you don't know how it's going to impact the UX, you don't know whether you really want to do it or not, or whether you want to make a trade-off. Cool? There was a question down here. How often do prototypes become what you end up shipping? How often do prototypes become? They don't. That's why we prototype. It's often fun to go back through a project and laugh at those early prototypes, which is why you have to have low investment in them emotionally, right? You have to be ready to throw them out. you know, sure, the prototype that we built a month before delivery is quite close, but, you know, in the first half of the project, the whole point is to go wide, I won't say go wild, go wide, explore different options, and we're totally going to throw a lot of them out, either because they were dumb ideas or because they were impractical from an implementation point of view or all sorts of reasons. So, yeah, our prototypes are often not like the thing that got built, but it got us all moving in the same direction. And you see that, I mean, a lot of people, when they set their five-year plan, they say the same thing. We're setting our five-year goal because we expect in five years' time we'll be there, but because if we don't have a direction for us all to move in now, in 5 years' time we'll be nowhere. You know what I mean? So we started off heading over there. 5 years' time we look back, and it turns out we went over there, but at least we all started off in the one direction. One more question, maybe? Yeah? Right. I imagine it's still being. You don't see it a lot, and I certainly I don't sort of do a lot of work in the traditional web space. I tend to do sort of applications and stuff like that, where you don't see that sort of stuff at all. It's still happening in web shops, but just as likely because of the new prototyping tools, that stuff is being done in a non-functional prototype in throwaway HTML or whatever. And then the first build is you're applying the style as you go. I mean, I don't know that there's one answer to that, but you're right. A few years ago, there was sort of everyone built a white site first and then you applied design. I don't think that happens so often now. Thanks, everyone, for your time. I'll take a couple more questions at the front. Thanks.